This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 244, was recorded on November 5th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by the Perth Mint, one of the world's largest precious metals enterprises and the leading provider of trusted gold investment products, including their latest offering, Gold Pass, and by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium. Natural resources investing guru Marin Katusa returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from MMT and how it will drive a secular bull market in precious metals to why some of the best mining companies are only listed on Canadian exchanges to how to allocate a precious metals portfolio to benefit from all of these trends. Exactly as we predicted months ago here on Macro Voices, the U.S. presidential election outcome is being contested. But now I want you to ask yourself a question. Just how contested could this thing get? And how much of a mess could this turn into for both the United States as a country and for financial markets before it's over? I've done a bit of research this week on the mechanics of the Electoral College system, and quite frankly, it's worse than I thought. So be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview for our post-game segment, when we'll take a deep dive on the Electoral College and specifically what happens next and what can still go wrong between now and Inauguration Day. We'll also have a post-game chart deck to discuss some post-election macro trends in the market.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's get to that S&P 500. In the post-election period, we've pretty much undid all of the selling and are pretty much back to October highs here. What's your take on all of this?
Well, remember what I said last week and the week before, which is I thought we were looking at a setup for a sharp rise in stock prices once the election was behind us and the outcome was reasonably clear. And I think it was certain that there would be some degree of contested election. We don't have total mayhem breaking out in the streets. It hasn't gone crazy at this point. And I think that what you're seeing right now, frankly, is a little bit of excessive complacency. I think just about everybody in the United States has been given the same message, which is the guy that you voted for won. And yeah, the other side is trying to steal the election, but we're not going to let him get away with it. Half of those people need to be disappointed sooner or later and find out that their guy didn't win, or maybe did win but isn't going to be allowed to take office or something. And I think that's where it gets a little bit uglier. So I think that we're in a false sense of certainty that's leading the stock market to recover because everybody's assuming, okay, it's not final results yet, but it'll be finalized in the next day or two, and then we'll be able to move on. I don't think it's going to be finalized in the next day or two. Of course, I could be wrong, but I think there's plenty of room for more volatility, particularly downside volatility, if we discover that this thing's not over quite as quickly as a lot of people think it's going to be over. We'll get into that in more detail in our post-game segment. Meanwhile, we have new news breaking today on the pandemic front. Danish researchers have discovered a new strain of coronavirus. It's basically in a mink farm, and so this is human to mink and back to human transmission. The salient point here is this new mutation of the SARS-CoV-2 virus appears to be non-responsive to all of the vaccines that are presently under development. So the consequence of that, if it is proven true, would be that potentially this new strain of coronavirus, the vaccines that are currently under development, might be effective against prior strains, but not against this new mutated strain. And that's very consistent with what we've discussed on Macro Voices in previous shows, where I've said, look, everybody's assuming the vaccine is just around the corner. There's never been a successful RNA virus vaccine in human beings ever before. And there's no reason to assume that it's going to come easily this time. So this virus is mutating quickly, and it may be that that this new mutation is going to present a new set of challenges. Now, does that mean prolongation of existing lockdowns and new lockdowns and so forth? I don't really think it's likely to go that way. I'm going to make a new prediction with respect not only to this current medical discovery, but the overall situation with the COVID-19 crisis. I think we're headed toward a situation where you're going to see the same kind of division in society that we see politically in the United States spreading globally. And it's going to be the crowd of people that on one side is saying, look, this is a horrible plague, a pandemic. We've got to take it seriously. We've got to go back into lockdown. We've got to do everything that we can to save as many people as possible. And there will be an opposite faction that says, look, we've already shut down the economy unnecessarily. It's not that big of a deal. Just let it burn through. Stop trying to fight it. Life has to move on. And I think that will lead to civil unrest between disagreeing factions of people in society who hold different views about how governments should respond to the evolving SARS-CoV-2 COVID-19 crisis. I hope I'm wrong about that, but I think that may be where it's headed. At this point, this new news about the new mutation, the mink virus, if you will, it's too new at this point to know whether it's a really serious big deal or not. We'll find that out in coming days. Hopefully, we'll have more news for you next week.
Eric, let's move on to that U.S. dollar, because the U.S. dollar has been so weak in the post-election period. We're back down toward the August and September lows. Do you think the U.S. dollar downtrend resumes from here?
I do think it resumes. And remember, even though I've been bullish in prior weeks, I said last week, look, don't interpret the strength we were seeing last week as a new uptrend. It's just the opposite side of liquidation flows that were occurring. Now what we're seeing is the reverse. People that were selling stocks and bonds and gold all at once last week are doing the opposite, and they're buying them and they're selling dollars in order to do that. And that's resulting in dollar down. I think that if my fears prove right and the election result stays, let's say, less clear for longer, lower for longer, I don't know what to call that. If it takes longer than most people are assuming to sort out this election result, I think the dollar could move significantly to the downside in the weeks and months ahead.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because we got a pretty heavy breakdown hitting that 34 handle, and then it snapped back. We're almost back towards 40. We're 38.66 on the December contract as we are recording. What's your take on the crude oil markets here?
Well, the coronavirus situation is still weighing on the market. The thing is that, and I think Libyan production coming back online also helped to push prices down. We had, I think, a 33 handle on WTI just very briefly intraday. Russia's statement that they were ready to support an OPEC Plus extension of production cuts was what turned the market around. So this Russia / OPEC Plus / Saudi Arabia political theater or jawboning theater, whatever you want to call it, it's going to continue as it always seems to continue. But frankly, in the long run, I think the coronavirus trend and more importantly, the election and political sentiment around whether or not the right response to the coronavirus, if it is worsening infections, as clearly seems to be the case in the data, does that mean governments should lock down again as they're already doing in the UK? Or does that mean that they should just let it burn through as some people have argued for? And who's going to be in power? And certainly with Biden saying one thing and Trump saying the opposite, the U.S. election is going to weigh on that significantly. So I think the coronavirus trend and what happens to demand as a result of whether or not more lockdowns in our future are ultimately going to be more important than whatever the latest jawbone statement is from Russia, OPEC, or Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, inventory this week, big unexpected drawdown on crude oil inventories of 8 million barrels. Now, Art Berman pointed out on Twitter, a lot of that was unaccounted for oil. So it may be a little bit of a reporting anomaly as opposed to that big of an unexpected drawdown really happening. And that certainly is supported by Cushing, Oklahoma, showing a build of 936,000 barrels this week. Gasoline building 1.5 million barrels. Distillates was the drawdown on the board of 1.6 million barrels, but not nearly as big as those 4 million plus drawdowns that we've been seeing in recent weeks. U.S. production back down by 600,000 barrels, erasing half exactly of last week's 1.2 million barrel increase. I think what's going on here is we're just seeing the reporting and the accounting for this data to stabilize a little bit after the tropical storms, right about where it should be at 10.5 million barrels of U.S. production reported this week. I don't think that we're yet seeing that big decline in U.S. production that Art Berman said to expect toward the end of the fourth quarter. Looks like we're stabilizing about where we should be. Tape action after inventory. This bullish news with the drawdown got us above the 13-day moving average, managed to hold above it for the last day and a half or so. As we're recording on Thursday afternoon, we're teetering just about 2 or 3 cents above the 38.61 13-day moving average, which is the highest of the three short-term moving averages. Generally speaking, closing prints above that level, and we did close above it today on Thursday, generally indicate a new uptrend, but we really haven't seen a close significantly above that level. So next few days will be telling. I wouldn't be surprised if there's another big move down in oil coming once we figure out that the election result is not really about to be determined in the next day or two, and particularly if we discover that the coronavirus is going to be complicated by a new strain which is resistant to vaccines.
Eric, let's move on to gold because we are breaking out of a six-week trade range. Gold looks very bullish here. Is this the beginning of a new uptrend?
Well, of course, our prediction here was, I said that if you had a uncontested election, a clear win by either party, that was going to be gold down. If you had a contested election, I predicted that would be gold up. That's exactly what we're getting. Now, so far, we've got a very impressive little rally in gold, but I mean, it's not new all-time highs or anything like that. I think that we could be headed toward a situation where this contested election gets a lot more contested before it's over. We'll come back to that subject in the post-game segment after the feature interview, but the point really with respect to gold is if that happens, I think it's definitely a catalyst to take gold much higher. Right now, what we're seeing is a rally based on this uncertainty. I suppose that if one side conceded and said, okay, you know, never mind, we'll let the other guy win and wish him well, then I think gold would tank on that news. Frankly, I don't think it's going to happen.
Eric, let's touch on these 10-year Treasury yields. With that split government, the market got spooked and the short sellers in the bond markets got squeezed. We had a pretty big drop in the yields. We're now trading down at the 77 basis point handle. What's your take on Treasury bonds here?
Well, Patrick, last week they were selling stocks, bonds, and gold all at once. It seems like this week they're buying stocks, bonds, and gold all at once. So I think what we're seeing is a reversal of last week's trade. And again, I don't think the contested election volatility is over yet. We'll talk more about that in postgame.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is natural resource investor Marin Katusa. Now, Eric, why did we invite Marin back to the show this week?
Well, clearly, regardless of who ultimately is president, we're going to get a lot more stimulus, a lot more debasement of fiat currency, not just by the United States Federal Reserve, but by central banks around the world. We heard, you know, the MMT argument from Stephanie Kelton a couple of weeks ago. And I just look at, what am I investing in? What am I focusing my attention on? Well, what's the smartest way to increase my allocation to precious metals when, from a location standpoint, it's kind of hard to add a lot of leverage on the gold itself? I'm looking at miners. I'm looking particularly at private placements and new gold mining companies where you get a little bit of leverage beyond just the gold price. Marin is the guy that I rely on, frankly, for private placement opportunities, and I have become a big fan of his newsletter. So I wanted to get Marin back on to talk to us about this precious metals bull market, about MMT and reactions that we've gotten from our audience to that interview, and just see what his take is on this and how we should play this gold bull market.
Well, Eric's interview with Marin Katusa is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
Financial markets are facing unprecedented uncertainty, driving investors to gold as a trusted store of wealth. For a simple, secure, and easy way to trade or invest, consider GoldPass, the Perth Mint's market-leading precious metals app.
GoldPass allows investors to buy, sell, redeem, and transfer precious metals 24 hours a day at the touch of a screen. Trade as little or as much as you want with no storage fees. With live gold prices, research, and interactive charting to help you decide when to trade, you can get started for as little as $1 worth of gold. Each digital certificate is 100% backed by physical Perth Mint gold stored in Western Australia, one of the safest jurisdictions in the world. And all assets traded by GoldPass carry a government guarantee. This means you can redeem your GoldPass holdings for bullion at any time and have your gold delivered direct to your door. Build your wealth with GoldPass today. Download the app in the Apple or Android store or visit perthmint.com/GoldPass.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Katusa Research founder, Marin Katusa. Marin, it's great to get you back on the show. It's been too long. You know, I just had Professor Stephanie Kelton on a couple of weeks ago, and it blew my mind. We've had more reaction to that interview than anything we've ever done on Macro Voices. And what surprised me was people are angry at me. The Sound Money crowd is upset. They're like, you had the traitor on your show. You know, you've defected. And I'm trying to tell these guys, look, I'm not endorsing this. I'm telling you, you got to get ready for what's coming, like it or not. Stephanie Kelton has really one of the most influential voices in public policy and finance right now. How do you see this? How should gold investors be thinking about MMT? Does it make sense to dismiss it, or should we take it seriously?
Look, Eric, I think anyone who's dismissing it is absolutely overlooking the biggest framework being applied, not just in the U.S., but there's about 65 countries in the world that have independent monetary and fiscal policy. That means that they can actually apply MMT. There's 192 countries in the world or somewhere around there. So you're looking at, this is the new framework. We've gone from the Austrian world of the gold standard, which, look, I am one of the largest players in the gold field, in the gold sector for financings. So I have even more pushback than you. You know, when I talked about the swap lines, all these guys are like, what are you talking about, Marin? And you know, they still want to play by the gold standard rule book. And that's just no longer the framework. Specifically, if the Dems do take the U.S. election here, which, you know, right now it's tilted in their favor, you know, Stephanie and her crew, right? Like Warren's one of her mentors. These are highly influential people, but more importantly, not to the old crew of, you know, the Hillary or the Biden or Bernie Sanders. They're still also somewhat stuck on the old rules playbook. You know, when Bernie Sanders said, you know, we'll give Medicare to everyone for free, Hillary responded with, you know, well, how are you going to do that? You know, how are you going to pay for it? Well, the next generation of the left, they're not going to ask those questions because, you know, under MMT, taxes are not how you fund the government program like you do in Austrian economics or early Keynesian economics. Taxes are two things. They create a domestic demand for the currency, which the government is the creator and, you know, issuer of. And think of it as a tap. It controls the tap on the inflation within the sector. That's what taxes are about in the MMT framework. So for all the gold guys out there, I am a gold guy. But you have to understand that MMT is not going to be a short term, like, you know, how QE just kind of popped up to kind of be a band-aid solution. I truly believe MMT is not just here for a year or two or five. I think it's going to be decades of MMT. And look at Japan. They've been doing it for almost 30 years and they've not been able to get the inflation going. So the demographics and all these factors, I think what Stephanie Kelton is doing needs to be specifically understood. This isn't even taught in universities yet. Like, this is, you know, it's a real-time experiment, and it's happening now, Eric.
I really want to ask you, because you're a dyed-in-the-wool gold guy, and this is the part that a lot of listeners really push back on me on. What I said is I think that when they do this, it will be perceived as fabulously successful for the first several years. And a lot of people got very upset with that, said, you're crazy, it's going to blow up the system, it'll never work. How do you see this? Because I think that it's going to have the appearance of working just fine for a while. Eventually, it will lead to serious problems. But at first, it's going to appear to be a success, and that means it feeds on itself, and they're going to spend and spend and spend. And it seems to me, as you say, the key to this, if you don't have to tax anybody to spend, they're going to spend like there's no tomorrow. And it seems to me that the debasement of all fiat currencies, not just the US dollar, but all global fiat currencies, is headed into a new phase of acceleration, which has to be good for gold. Am I missing anything?
Well, you know, what I would add, first of all, I'm with you on this. Second of all, as, you know, the euro goes digital, right? Think of it, you know, people forget that it was the US that held on to the gold standard 40 years longer than Canada or the UK or Germany or Russia or China or Japan. It was the last, you know, Switzerland is a different story, but I mean like the nations that had a big military and large economy. On that basis, I also believe that the US dollar will probably be one of the last major currencies to go digital. And in that shift, as you go digital, gold will be even more dominant as a, you know, off digital currency. You know, cash is going to be kind of pushed out, but gold will still be even more. And with that, you're going to have a few of the cryptos, and you're going to have, you know, the government cryptos. Like, you're an expert in that. You wrote your book, and when you came to my conference, we really tried to explain that to people. But yeah, like, look, at the end of the day, you're looking at gold, and more specifically, where are they finding gold, Eric? People forget that, you know, you look at the last 30 years of gold exploration, over 2/3 of the exploration dollars have been in the last decade, but they found less than 10% of the gold in the last decade versus the last 30 years. And more importantly, where are they finding the gold? They're not finding big world-class tier one deposits like they were 30 years ago. And the time to develop these is getting ever longer. And more importantly is in what jurisdictions, the political risk. Look, in the last 60 days, you've had over 15 nations increase taxes, royalties, ownership structures on foreign-owned developed mines. That trend is going to continue, and the governments around the world, I know this is going to piss off a lot of our viewers in this, but the US dollar still is the currency of choice. For all those people who are saying, well, you know, the yuan is going to dump, you know, the Chinese are going to dump their dollars in the treasury. That's not how it works. It's not like they're going to, you know, go to the Fed and go, give me my $2 trillion back. That's not, it's a digits on a ledger. And Eric, most importantly, it's they can't go and use those US dollars to buy oil from Iran. You know, you have your sanctions list, and they can't convert it to gold, the Chinese. So that whole concept that they're going to dump it into the market is ridiculous. And why would they do that when they're pegged to this currency? So, you know, there's a whole issue there. But look what happened with the anti-IPO. You know, Jack Ma got a little bit aggressive and made some comments about the banks in China, and boom. You know, they pulled the IPO. Now, what is the real reason? Who knows? But the point is why would you want to be investing in a regime that can change on a 180 dime based off of some comments? So at the end of the day, as bad as the US dollar is, it's still better than the others. And slowly, gold will be much more attractive to non-US individuals. And this is something you and I talked about a couple of years ago. You know, if you're in Turkey or Argentina or Yugoslavia when it was still around, or look at Russia or any of the stands, your devaluation, you know, if you had some gold, it was an ultimate inflation hedge. Americans aren't thinking that way yet, but the rest of the world is.
Here's the thing I really don't understand. I'm reading the work of some people that have been around the gold industry for a long, long time. And they're saying, you know, you got to understand, this bull market is a bull market, but it's pretty well developed now. The price of gold has just about bottomed from that low that it hit a few years ago up to the recent peak. It's just about doubled. And people are saying, you know, this is a great bull market, but maybe it's, to use the baseball analogy, in the seventh or eighth inning at this point. Now, I know you just wrote about this in the last episode of your newsletter. Share your perspective, because I don't think we're anywhere close to the eighth inning. How do you see this baseball game?
First of all, I totally agree with you. And how this all kind of came about was my good friend Ross Beattie and Tom Kaplan and I did a little bit of a online interview for this large conference to give the keynote talk. And, you know, Ross kind of said, well, you know, I think we're in the fourth or fifth inning. And Tom said, well, I think I'm in the early innings. And, you know, and I kind of sat there and I went, you know, I actually don't think we're in the big leagues yet. And let me explain why. I think we're probably in the seventh or eighth inning of AAA ball. You know, we're in the farm leagues. We're playing in stadiums that hold 2,000 or 3,000 people, not, you know, Wrigley Field with over 50,000. You look at the large funds, the pension funds, the sovereign wealth funds. You look at the incredible amount of capital in the passive management sector, and that's continuing to grow. I do not see, Eric, the, you know, you look at where Canada is for the number of companies listed is on the gold side is well over 450. And then you look at the gold companies on the New York, you got, you know, somewhere around 40. So the prime time, you know, the big leagues is the New York Stock Exchange. Now, why? Well, look at the financing sector. Where is the money coming from? Over 80% of it is American money or coming through America. Canada is not, you know, yes, we are the capital of financing for these companies because it's the industry, it's where the geos and engineers and the companies, but the capital is not coming from Canada or Australia. It's the fact of the matter is it's coming from the US. So when you have the qualifications to list on the New York Stock Exchange, that's the big leagues. You know, Canada, I'm Canadian. I'm a big fan of Canada. But here's the reality. You know, there's too many garbage companies that are listed that are taking up space, and the big money is not going to take US dollars, convert it into Canadian dollars, get dinged by the brokers. And most of the brokerage firms, like, you know, the banks in the US can't even own or buy these stocks in the financing. So the mining sector has to adapt and evolve and go to where the customers are. And frankly, I know people are going to hate when I say this, but that's the US exchange. So I don't even think we're yet in the big leagues yet. And for where I am, at, I only want to own assets that are big league available, you know, tier one category killers, as Tom Kaplan calls them, with tier one management teams that are heavily invested, meaning that their life is going to be much more impacted if this doesn't work than my own, meaning they got skin in the game. And these are assets that are going to attract the capital of, you know, the passive managements, you know, look at the GDXJ, for example. That's the junior sector. They're not buying any juniors. Juniors meaning, you know, sub $100 million market cap. They're not doing that. A junior to them is something like Equinox, which produces well over 500,000 ounces a year. That's what a junior's come to the big leagues. So that's where it's at. And a lot of guys have a hard time because the industry, Eric, is based off of, you know, I call it B's and fees or fees and B's. The bankers love their fees. They charge 7-8% commission. They charge 7-8% in broker warrants. The lawyers get it. The accountants get it. It's kind of like an old boys club. The exchange charges these companies for listing. You know, the exchange is a business in itself. And I'm making a lot of enemies talking about this, but it's the reality of the situation.
I want to come back to the Canada angle of this and companies that are listed in Canada, because I know you've written about that recently. But first, I want to go deeper on this question of hitting the big leagues, because it seems to me like, look, for years and years now, yeah, sure, there's a lot of these companies are listed in Canada, but there's also plenty of gold mining companies that have been listed on U.S. exchanges for decades. And frankly, it's stuff that gold bugs buy. You know, we had Milton Friedman calling gold a barbarous relic and so forth. Really, institutional investors, almost as a matter of reputation risk, don't want to hold gold in an institutional portfolio because, you know, that's just not done anymore. I mean, and if you look at what's going on with MMT about to change the world and all fiat currency on the verge of being debased, it seems to me that when you get some kind of catalyst where it becomes culturally acceptable for institutional money managers to have gold mining shares in their portfolios because they understand the macro argument for it, all of a sudden the world changes and floodgates open. What is the catalyst? What does it take to change the investment mindset, to get all these, you know, institutional guys where the really big money is to say, wait a minute, we used to think of gold and gold mining shares is kind of all those kooky gold bugs. But, you know, maybe there's a time and a place for everything. And the time and the place for gold is right now when Stephanie Kelton and company are counseling governments on how to debase fiat currency all around the world?
The simple answer is this. I published a report talking about the yield of over the last 150 years from the mining companies. And it all kind of changed in the late 70s and 80s when MBAs and accountants took over these companies. And it no longer became a business. A business is like your business or my business or any business. You want positive cash flow. You want to make money at the end of the year. And the mining sector became about, you know, specifically the gold bugs started dictating the terms, and it became about growth. It became about production. You know, it was based off of higher gold prices. So let's go down the food chain on the projects. It's got to go back to the basics. And you look at guys like Barrick, you know, run by Mark Bristow, or another great example would be Agnico Eagle run by Sean Boyd. These guys have come out publicly and said, yeah, gold's $1,900, but we're not using $1,900 in our M&A. We're going to use $1,250 or $1,300. Why? Because look what's happened in the last 20 years. Massive wealth destruction. You know, how many CapEx overruns? Well, everybody wants to go build a mine at the same time. You know, when we built Copper Mountain, when we started it 14 years ago, we had to sign up 3 years in advance to get a crusher, you know, the big SAG mills and the ball mills. And we had to wait in line, and we were like number 48th in line. And if we didn't make our payments, we wouldn't get the crusher to site by 2010 or 2011 back in 2008. Well, the global financial crisis happened and a lot of companies just bailed on making their payments. So we accelerated and got it earlier. But my point is it's the classic boom bust setup on such a cyclical business. Until it goes to a basic cash flow, paying yield, increasing yield, you know, in that standpoint, in an MMT world where we're going negative, where the governments are going to increasingly buying their bonds, that's when the gold companies will go into the big leagues and will become prime time, and not just the active managers, but the passive management money will start, you know, coming into the sector, because people want to get paid and make money off a sound business, not speculation, meaning gold has to go to 2,400, then I get paid. That ain't going to work for the big leagues. It's got to be a real business.
Now, for the benefit of our investor audience, let's talk about the different leagues, if you will, because on one hand, you've just made a very good argument that says, look, you know, where the really big action is going to happen eventually, it has to be in U.S. markets, which is where all the capital is. That's where the world is really going to change. But at the same time, you just wrote in your newsletter quite extensively about the culture, if you will, of the Vancouver finance community and why they tend to put all these new gold companies on Canadian exchanges. Tell us a little bit of that about that. Particularly, do investors really need to be prepared to invest in Canadian dollars? Is there something you gain? Is there an advantage that you get if you're an American investor to going through that hassle of, you know, opening an account that's able to trade the TSX and converting US dollars to Canadian dollars and all that? Is there a reason to do that, or are you better off to just stick with US listed companies if you're in the US?
Look, when it comes to early stage exploration and when you do a financing, you get a warrant. The earlier stuff is listed in Canada, which, you know, 99% of the time the financings are done in Canadian dollars. Now, there have been financings that they would accept US dollars because these companies do need US dollars. They fix the exchange rate and they move forward. Now that we've been involved in a few of those. But the point is that, yes, you should have the account available. But, you know, what people have to understand is you're also then, if you're an American, like my fund is American dollars fund. Now, in 2011, when we put all that money in, the dollar was par. By doing nothing, the US dollar fund, you know, if you're investing in the Canadian stock, and let's just say it hasn't gone down, it hasn't gone up, you would have lost over 30% just because of the currency factor. So this is something that people have to really pay attention to. When you start converting dollars, you also have to focus on the currency play that will affect you, regardless of your investment. Okay, so that's number one. And I talk a lot about that. Number two, this whole belief that you have to buy something really early stage with these geos with a box of crayons, with, you know, maps who dress up and try to look like Indiana Jones. And, you know, they were socially awkward in university and now they, you know, think they're studs because they're using public money at bars and, you know, they're doing that game. Look, I've been there and done it, Eric. Okay. And you don't need to play the early super high risk to get the returns. I've talked about this for years in my newsletter. You look at the big caps, they've actually outperformed the juniors, and you're looking at way, way orders of magnitude less risk Okay, everything's about what is my risk-adjusted return? What type of risk am I taking for this return? And I sat there a few years ago and saying, the game's changing. Where's the money? And the big money from like, it kind of ended at 2011, 2012 is when the big funds got so burnt by playing the illiquid other currency, playing the Canadian, if you're American dollars, and, you know, this early stage stuff that they didn't quite understand and the promotion and all the factors that come into the game, where they're looking at it going, geez, you know, I can make four times my money on an Equinox that's now on its way to produce 1 million ounces, or like in our newsletter where we made three times your money on a 1 million ounce producer called B2 Gold, run by my buddy Clive Johnson. The point is, you know, you look at these exploration stories taking all that risk and they've doubled or tripled. Now, me personally, mathematically speaking, if I had a junior that went up five times, but is very risky, say a sub 100 million market cap, 50 million market cap that goes up five times, or a mid cap or a major that goes up two or three times, I would every day of the week take the double or triple over that five bagger because of the risk involved. Okay. And I can walk through hundreds of examples why. Liquidity, the risk adjustment returns, you know, the depth of bench of assets. Is this a one asset company or does it have a portfolio? All these different factors. And the money, you know, the bell that was rung that the industry ignored was when the GDXJ restructured about 3-4 years ago and said, hey, you know, we were created, the GDX was supposed to be for the big companies and mid-tiers that are producers. And the GDXJ was supposed to be, you know, originally inception was for the discoveries, the companies that are going to develop into producers. Well, you know, is B2 and Kinross a junior? Well, they're in the GDXJ, right? So there was a huge pivot. Why? Because they significantly underperformed. The investors didn't want to own it. So the manager said, well, we either have to adapt and change or we're going out of business. So they adapted and changed. So in this business, you can still think that the gold standard rules apply to economics, and so many people, look, I get it. Like, you and I get the reasons why people want to go back to the gold standard, but that's not reality, right? So you either play with the rules ahead and the framework that we have at hand, or you live in a bubble. And if you're going to live in a bubble, it's going to pop and it's going to be awful for you.
Marin, let's come back to the MMT prognostications that we started with at the top of this interview. You and I both think that, you know, we don't know yet, as we're speaking on Wednesday, a day before this interview will air on our podcast. The election has not been called yet. There's still a bit of a leaning toward a Democratic Biden win in the polls, but we're not even sure of that. One way or another, regardless of who's president, I think you and I agree that governments, not just in the United States, but around the world, are going to continue to print and spend money. That's going to mean a lot of infrastructure projects. It's going to mean eventually, I think, inflation coming into the economy. What does it mean for natural resources? And particularly, you know, where do we want to be investing? Is that in some ways maybe an argument for gold rather than the mining shares? How do we interpret the MMT prognostication and translate it to the market?
For sure. So regardless from a framework on economics, it's irrelevant who wins the election, because the only difference is the Democrats want to direct where the money's going to go and Republicans want to have the free market kind of direct where the money's going to go. So that's really the only difference here. Now, depending on, you know, where the Senate is, the next 2 years is going to be a lot of gridlock if Biden wins, because it does look like the Republicans will hold. So, you know, the stimulus will still come, but it's going to be debated and it's going to, you know, create more market volatility. But regardless, we know what MMT is going to do. You have the sovereign wealth funds, you know, trying to dictate against the carbon and all these factors. So, you know, when you talk about inflationary, where you're going to see incredible amounts of capital come in is the green energy sector. And this is something we talked about in March in the newsletter. And in the green energy sector, it comes down to one thing. I wrote about this in 2015, Eric. Cost of capital. That's it. That's all that matters. It's not like you're having this geologist who's got a brilliant idea and he finds this gold deposit where no one else bothered looking. With the green energy, it's, hey, you know, what is it going to cost us to build this? What is our PPA, our 30-year contract with the state or the government or the company's power purchase agreement? And, you know, what do we clip? You know, what is our net gain? It's really a financial engineering industry. The bigger you are, the lower your cost of capital, the better you can grow. That's just how it goes. So a startup green energy company, its cost of capital will be anywhere between 8% and 17%. Well, if you take some of the big boys like Brookfield or NextEra, their cost of capital is anywhere between 1% and 4%. So through math, how could a startup, you know, compete? It just can't. So my thesis is, again, stay with the big leagues, liquidity, and the market is going to be funding the big boys to continue their growth. That said, what happens there? So I kind of coined this phrase called crossflation. You're going to see incredible inflation in areas like the offshore wind and, you know, the capexes, cost overruns, labor, the whole setup. And then you're going to see deflationary pressures in the coal and the natural gas sector that is going to be losing its market share to that. So you're going to see deflationary pressures in certain areas of the energy patch and inflationary pressures. Now, here's something, if you really want to get all these gold bugs, you know, thinking we're crazy, Eric, is I published something called the GBO concept, green barrels of oil equivalent, back in my newsletter. And I said, look, when I took on the Altera project, which got bought out by Energex, I tried to explain to the oil patch that their cost of capital was significantly lower than the green energy patch, because the green energy patch went through its boom, bust, and echo with the first green revolution when Obama took over in 2009. So what happened then? You know, all these projects eventually got built, but investors got bored of the reality of a utility, because that's what green energy is. It's just a fancy utility that makes everyone feel good rather than burning coal or natural gas. It's windmills and sunlight and run of river and hydro, right? Or geothermal. Now, what happened then? You know, all these oil companies, you look at, you know, Exxon, Chevron, I talk to directors of Suncor, all these massive, big companies with hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap. And they looked at the math and they said, you know, this is really cool. You're a nerd, but, we're a real energy company. Green energy doesn't make money. And I would argue that actually, guys, it does. Look at the cost deflationary pressures. And they didn't want to educate themselves. Fast forward 5 years. And this is where it sounds crazy. Brookfield today has a bigger market cap than Suncor. Now, Brookfield's Canada's largest green energy company, Suncor's Canada's largest oil company, and Brookfield can now buy out Suncor. And 5 years ago, that would have been a joke. In the US, NextEra is America's largest green energy company, and it's got a bigger market cap than Exxon. And people think that's crazy. Well, the cost of capital for Brookfield or NextEra is lower than Suncor or Exxon. And they can now use the same math that the oil patch used, where they took natural gas and converted it into a barrel of oil equivalent using the formulas that I published. And I think in the next 10 years, you're going to see all these Goldman Sachs savvy guys make the push and be funded by MMT, because it's ESG acceptable. It feels good. It creates jobs. And the only way you're going to phase out oil, which, you know, the Democrats have clearly stated they will, well, is to own it. Therefore, imagine a world where the green energy companies start buying out the oil patch and use the barrels of oil equivalent, you know, the green barrels, where every barrel of oil is used to fund a new green barrel of oil. And it's, you know, technically, mathematically, you can argue that the sun is an infinite royalty. And that changes the game for the oil patch. The cost of capital, the recycle ratios, the return on investment, everything is in favor for the green energy companies to do it. And how is it going to be fueled? MMT. And if you think that it's not going to happen, well, I can guarantee you this. MMT is not going to be plowing billions or trillions into the oil patch, because that's not what the agenda is. Right. So as crazy as it sounds, Eric, is it crazy that Tesla has a bigger market cap than Toyota or GM or Ford? But that's the reality we're in.
Now, along those lines, another question I wanted to ask you. I was talking to someone else the other day who's been around the gold mining industry for a long time. And I was asking him about gold mining and the opportunities. He said, you know what? I think the biggest opportunities in mining right now, despite what's going on with money printing and all this, it's not even in gold mining, it's in copper mining. And the reason is you've got infrastructure spend coming no matter what, regardless of who's in the White House. They're going to do a lot of infrastructure spend. And electric vehicles are huge copper consumers. There has to be a huge copper market. And this one individual, at least, thought that the opportunity in copper mining was even better than the gold mining opportunity. What's your reaction to that?
Well, look, what the individual was probably saying was copper porphyries. And copper, historically, the base metal producers have traded at a considerable discount to the gold producers. This goes back all the way down to Canada's greatest mining company. Basically, the foundation of Barrick was a company called Placer. Placer were the guys that really took copper porphyries, big open pit, bulk tonnage, you know, 0.5, 0.6, 0.7% copper, which, you know, 35, 40, 50 years ago was considered low grade. Today it's considered high grade. And what they did was they created considerable cash flow, like the largest mining companies were always base metal companies. Then when gold started rocking in the 70s, the gold companies, because of gold bugs, were a little bit less disciplined on the financial analysis of it all. And they're going to hate when I say this, but here's a fact. Placer Dome eventually became Placer Dome, got bought out by Barrick in 06. Placer was the mining guys. It was run by engineers, you know, guys like Jim O'Rourke, Eric Schultz. These are really smart, successful guys who built multiple mines around the world and is based off cash flow and yield. But Dome Ventures was a gold company that, you know, kind of cyclical and didn't really make that great of cash flow, but it had it traded at a higher multiple. So the bankers was Dome. It took over the real mining guys. That became Placer Dome. And, you know, in the boardroom, the bankers were a little bit, the bankers and accountants were a bit more savvy than the engineers who built the mines because they were actually working rather than manipulating. And they took over. And that's how Barrick became Barrick, was taking over Placer Dome. So today, the copper guys trade at a significant discount to the gold producers. Okay, on whether you want to talk on a NAV basis, a PE multiple, it doesn't matter. But the big problem with the copper guys is now that the porphyries have, you know, the low hanging fruit has been produced, the capex are very high and the market is very shy of that. So depending on where your porphyry is, Eric, which jurisdiction, infrastructure, do you have electricity? You know, is it a camp where you have to, you know, house and feed your guys, or can they drive up from a town locally? All these costs, like, you know, labor is a big cost. Electricity is a big eight cost. You got all these crushing is a big cost. How hard's the rock, the metallurgy? Where are you sending your concentrate? And where I think the future is, and I've been writing about this, is copper porphyries with high gold and silver credits, not moly. So there's different types of porphyries, and you don't really want a molybdenum byproduct, because if you have a good gold byproduct or a silver, you can do a stream or a royalty on the on your byproduct, and it'll help fund your copper. So yes, I believe that that's an interesting thing. I've been writing about it. But again, Eric, mining is such a difficult business. Just because you have a big copper deposit, will it be mineable? And is it realistic? And it's so many factors that come into play: jurisdictional risk, permitting, where it is, infrastructure risk, and all those different aspects.
Marin, let's tie this all together. Let's suppose that the hypothetical investor wants to allocate $1 million to the natural resources sector and sees the MMT coming and everything, currently has no exposure to mining, whether it be gold or base metals or anything else. What percentage do we put into precious metals versus non-precious metals, natural resources? In the precious metals space, how much of that goes into the big cap companies versus the juniors versus private placements in startups? What's the breakdown of how you would approach that for, let's say, a family office or high net worth individual?
For sure. Like, you know, for 20 years, I've seen so many booms and busts in our sector where you have the private money come in. First of all, don't make the number one mistake everyone does is they're excited. They come in and they go, I've got $1 million or 100 grand or 500 grand or 5 million, whatever the number is. And they go, I need to now get into the game. And they start buying and buying and buying. That's the number one mistake. Be an alligator. And I use these analogies to really try to, you know, so people can visualize. An alligator can go a year without eating. It can control its metabolism. So number one thing is control your impulse. It feels good. Like, I'm the first guy to admit, like, you know, it feels great to negotiate a term and be the lead order and be the big swinging dick in the room. You got to control your impulses. Stay super disciplined. One of the biggest lessons I learned in the business is never try to compete with other financiers in the game on terms, because you're competing against yourself. What you want to be doing is being the source of capital when there's no one else there, number one. Number two, work towards building your allocation. I do this thing called the tranches. I always talk about it. So let's separate investments, Eric, versus speculations. Investments is, am I getting paid a dividend? Is this money, you know, is the company producing something? Are they building towards it? Or a speculation is I'm buying it because I think they're going to find a deposit, or I think they're going to be bought out. It's catalyst driven rather than cash flow and dividend and growth driven, which is investments. So right off the bat, I'm 2/3 investment driven, 1/3 speculation. Now, I never put more than 10% of my whole portfolio into any one stock on an investment, and on a speculation, never put more than 5% of your entire portfolio into any one stock. And I ease into these positions. The best way to do it, Eric, is private placements. You get the warrant kicker, and it blows my mind. All the fund managers out there, and you keep saying, oh, Marin Katusa and his Katusa warrant, he's an idiot. No, you're an idiot. For those people to think that warrants are bad for the business. Warrants, if they're private and not listed, yes, they're an overhang. But you as an investor are taking considerable amounts of risk. And these management teams issue themselves options for 5 years. And I sit here and going, wait a second, I'm taking all the risk. I'm putting all the capital in. You get options for 5 years and you're telling me you're not going to give me a warrant? Go fuck yourself, right? So the whole point here is, you know, you want to invest in management teams who are writing huge checks and not abusing the options. It always starts with the people. And what I have found is if I can get a full 5-year warrant out of Ross Beaty, who, by the way, owns over 10% of the company himself and has invested $200 million of his own money at a price higher than our subscribers, and we got a full 5-year warrant that lists and trades, Eric, that's the way to play the game, is those types of deals. The private placements is the way to go. That's how you should start, specifically if you're an accredited investor. It's a huge advantage. And you know, this is something you don't learn in the CFA program or MBA programs. Why? Because the teachers aren't investors. And like, look, I started out as a teacher, so I'm always fighting for the underdog guy. It's just my nature. But the reality is this whole business is set up where the bankers give the best deals to their big high net worth or big fund managers. They get the warrant, but the retail crowd doesn't. The whole business is upside down. So I'm trying to change it, you know, take it away from the institutions, take it away from the bankers and the brokerages, and take those fees away, keep them in the company, and give us the warrants for taking the risk and list them. Because, Eric, here's another thing. There are so many funds out there that are not allowed to buy mining stocks because it's against their actual articles of incorporation of their funds, but they want exposure to the gold sector. But you see, warrants are, it's an option. It's no different than a put or a call. And these fund managers, you know, a great example is when I did the Katusa warrant on Northern Dynasty. I get a phone call from the CEO and he's going, Marin, what the hell's going on? The warrants are actually trading higher than the share price. That makes no sense. And I go, well, you're not understanding that the funds that are speculating in it, they can't buy the stock. So they're buying the warrant. And here's a great example for these who invested at 45 cents and you get a full 5-year listed tradable warrant at 65 cents. The warrants are trading at $4. You could sell your warrant at $4 and keep your stock for free. Whereas the old business was set up at, you know, the brokerages, they would sell their stock to the retail crowd and keep their warrants as an overhang. You know, they would call, you know, peel the shares and ride the warrant was the old saying. And I'm saying by listing those warrants, you could sell your warrant and keep your share. And that's what's happened with Equinox and Northern Dynasty. I can walk through many, many examples on that. So for everyone out there that thinks warrants are, you know, you wouldn't believe how many management teams saying, well, my big investor doesn't like warrants. And I'm like, that big investor ain't going to be lasting in the business that long. So you might want to think twice.
Now, Marin, I'm just going to slow you down a little bit here because I personally am both a subscriber to your newsletter and I've participated in your private placements, so I know what you're talking about. But just for the benefit of some of our listeners who may not be veterans of natural resource investing, what is sometimes part of these private placements is in addition to buying shares for money, which is, of course, what a private placement is, the investor also gets a warrant or more frequently a half warrant. So for every 2 shares you buy, you get an option to buy another share. Usually that's a long dated option called a warrant that's good for several years. The way most people in the business did this is, okay, you've got this private company that's maybe going to go public at some point, but it's not yet. And now I've got a warrant in it, and that warrant is a piece of paper that I can only exercise with the company. You've taken a different approach of getting not just the shares listed on an exchange, but the warrants listed on an exchange, so that your investors in the private placements that are receiving both shares and warrants, not only can they sell the shares on the exchange, but they can also sell and trade the warrants on the exchange. And that's what you mean by a CATUSA warrant. So I just want to get that terminology clear, because otherwise we're going to be inundated by people saying, what the heck is Marin talking about?
Yes, you're entirely correct. But the one thing I want to phrase to everyone is the industry uses private placement. You know, it doesn't mean that the company's private. What's ironic about the private placement, it's street code for the inside crew. Private means it's not for everybody. So you could have many of these publicly listed companies that are doing private placements. It's just another fancy term for a financing or an equity raise or whatever. The big difference of what I've been trying to push the industry to do is the bankers don't like listing the warrants because it's an inherent financing down the road if you list them. Bankers don't get paid fees on that. And more importantly, to list a warrant, you need to have 100 investors, accredited investors minimum, to list the warrant, with no one owning over 80% of the warrants. There's like some rules. And bankers hate handling over 100 subforms for financing. They like to go to their 10 largest funds or their 12 largest funds, and you know, they tuck in the deals, they wink, wink, nudge, nudge, let's go on a closing party. It's really an old boys network. And I came in with my, you know, East Van style saying, yeah, well, I'm not a blue blood, I'm self-made, and I don't mesh with that crowd. This is how I'm gonna be doing it. It's my money. I'm the lead order, but to play against the big boys in the field, I need my alligator pact. I'm very open about that. They come in at the same terms, at the same price, at the same time. So it's become a me versus them, but it's just me. I need my alligator pact, which are my subscribers. And I say, rather than keeping these warrants private, an overhang, I'm educating the management teams, and it's becoming more and more accepted. You'll see it's now becoming a hey, this makes sense. Look at these companies. They're doing well. And they're liquid and they're moving forward. So list the warrants. It's a little bit more effort on the management team's part, but it's becoming more and more mainstream with more and more time. And more importantly, I hope there becomes more volatility and liquidity, because so many of these funds that aren't fighting for the basics and the fundamental proper values, they're fly-by-night money. They're very quick money. That's the opposite of what I do. You've seen for how long I've been talking about Equinox. I come in and I believe the Warren Buffett strategy is when you buy shares, you're a partner in the company and you try to add value. Like when I bought Altera and I became the major shareholder outside of Ross, who is the chairman and the largest, I become a partner in the company, and I worked with the management team to show how the debt, and all, it's a complicated story. I wrote it in my newsletter, but it was me pushing on the default of the debt, how it would be accretive by defaulting on a debt. I know that sounds crazy, but you know, that's the type of stuff that I get involved in and bring projects to the companies and merger ideas. I'm a very active, positive investor. There's a whole crew out there that are, you know, activist investors that try to go against management teams. My thesis is life's too short. Number two, why do I want to fight a management team when, you know, the odds are against me in the resource sector to take it on? Number three, why not just find the best management teams, work with them, try to get in at their cost base or lower, make sure that they're the largest shareholders, and work with them in a positive way to create shareholder wealth? That's been my framework, and it's played out really well, and that's where I'm going to continue. And I'm more leaning towards big league assets with big league management teams that have big league cash flow, because after going to hundreds and hundreds of projects, you know, the headache of building a small, crappy mine is the same as building a big mine. The difference is crappy profits versus big profits. So I prefer the big profits.
Marin, we're just about out of time, but before I let you go, I do want to ask you about your newsletter, which you've just been alluding to. Look, let's face it, you're kind of in a different part of this newsletter business than a lot of the newsletter writers that we talk to that are doing these $200 or $300 a year things. Frankly, if an investor has a $10,000 investable net worth, it would be foolish to spend a third of it subscribing to your newsletter. So who is your newsletter for? Who's the target audience? Who benefits from it? And it's not cheap. It's usually $3,500 a year. I know Patrick, my producer, has beaten your guys down to, I think it's $19.95 for a subscription instead of the usual $3,500. But we're still talking $2,000. Who pays that? Who does it make sense for? And what does it include?
It's guys like you, Eric. It's guys that are serious about their portfolio. You know, this isn't a, you know, $19 monthly membership where you feel like, I'm going to go to the gym and you don't. This is for guys that really want to educate themselves on how mining companies are built, true analysis, and skin in the game. I've never understood, Eric, why anyone would subscribe to a newsletter where the author or the, you know, the guru, as you would call it, don't buy the stock. Because I can guarantee you, Eric, when these deals go against me and I'm the largest investor in the deal, you better believe I think about it all the time and at nighttime and how to fix it. It's not just another armchair analysis. Oh, well, that didn't work. Well, yeah, no, I'm the lead guy on all these PPs and you've seen it yourself. So, you know, who should be investing in it? One thing I've seen is we're seeing a huge increase in professional females. That's been the biggest growth in our newsletter. It used to be old white dudes. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years now, and it used to be that, you know, Republican. It's changing, Eric. We have subscribers in over 100 countries. And the biggest growth is professional females who've, you know, are looking at this sector going, hey, this makes sense. It's cheap. I want to invest in private placements. And that's been the biggest change I've seen over the last 20 years from, you know, back when I was the main guy for Doug Casey and then when I learned my chops. And make sure if you're investing in it, it's a journey. It's the Ironman approach. This is not a sprint. And in like my report that I'm publishing today is 47 pages long with complete detailed analysis. I'm not one of these guys that write cool stories that make you laugh and like, you know, witty, this and that. It's about making money and nothing else.
Well, when it hits my inbox, I always click and open it just about instantly. It gets my attention and often there's actionable advice there. So I really appreciate a terrific interview. We look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Uranium, the fuel for nuclear power, is a contrarian investment whose returns are historically uncorrelated to other asset classes. Low uranium prices lasted for many years after the Fukushima meltdown, leading to substantial supply destruction. At today's prices, uranium mining is uneconomical even for the world's lowest cost producers. Uranium demand is already estimated to exceed existing supply, and future demand growth is expected. New mines aren't economically viable at today's prices, leading analysts to predict that the price of uranium may need to double to over $60 per pound to incentivize sufficient new mine supply to meet expected demand. The NYSE-listed North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, offers investors exposure to both miners and holders of uranium. For more information, visit urnmetf.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great interview with Marin Katusa. And for our listeners, there's a link in your Research Roundup email to the special offer allowing MacroVoice listeners to subscribe to Marin's newsletter for $1,999 instead of the usual $3,500 price tag. You can also find the offer at katusaresearch.com/macrovoices. But frankly, Eric, something about Marin's pitch sounds a little too good to be true. It's pretty bold promising his subscribers that he'll tell them before he sells his stock so they can get a chance to sell their shares first. Marin's a pretty big investor in these deals himself and has a lot of his own capital at risk. Why in the world would he invite his subscribers to effectively front run him by telling them in advance before he starts selling the stock in his model portfolio? And on the private placements, he says his subscribers get exactly the same deal he gets, and he claims he doesn't make any capital introduction commissions for setting up the deal, which is completely at odds with the industry norms. Now, Eric, I know you subscribe to Marin's newsletter yourself. What's going on here? Is everything really as advertised?
Well, frankly, Patrick, I was extremely skeptical at first. And, you know, this is compounded. Marin kind of has a salesman personality, too. And I kind of wondered, okay, what is this guy's game. And in short, it's mostly as advertised. And I quite have come to really appreciate the newsletter and the value that I get from it. There are a couple of not so obvious little gotchas in this story, though. So let's debunk the Marin sales pitch, if you will, and talk about what the straight scoop is, what's real and what's not real. And to understand that, I think you've got to have the backstory of how this marketplace works, the way private placements usually work. First of all, in the gold mining business, unlike something like software, where you have a very vibrant venture capital community that's financing the growth of most of these companies. In the gold mining space, they need private placements to accredited investors to come and buy shares in these companies while they're still private, before they go public, in order to develop their mines and get to the point where they're producing gold and they can float a public offering and actually take the company public. Now, the brokers that introduce accredited investors to these deals usually get to keep about 6 to 10% of the money that's being raised in the form of commissions. And the mining companies, of course, they hate paying those commissions, but that's just the reality of the industry. Sometimes the brokers are getting a percentage of the cut. Other times, they kind of change the shape of it to hide it. So the story that's told to the investor is, the broker's not taking any of your money as a commission. 100% of your money that you're paying for these shares goes to the company, and they keep your money, and the broker doesn't get any of it. Well, what they don't tell you is the company is also issuing warrants, which are like long-dated options, call options to buy the stock at a certain price. And the brokers are getting those warrants in lieu of a commission in exchange for providing the introduction to the accredited investors and so forth. So they can tell the investors the company got to keep all the money, which is technically true, but they didn't tell you that the company actually did pay a significant compensation to the brokers in the form of warrants. Now, what's going on? Why does Marin have his newsletter? What is he trying to do here? What's he trying to accomplish? What I've figured out over the last couple of years is Marin, I think, wants to be the George Soros of natural resource investing. He wants to be the guy who's got so much money that he can tell these mining companies, look, forget about the brokers, forget about their commissions, forget about their accredited investors. I'm such a Daddy Warbucks, big money guy that I can do the whole deal for you. I can finance your entire capital raise myself. I'm going to buy all the stock that you need to sell me, and I want you to give me better terms because I'm such a, you know, big heavyweight guy that I can do the entire deal myself. Marin's a very wealthy guy, but he's not quite that wealthy. So the reason he has this newsletter, as far as I can tell, is it allows him to effectively increase his own buying power so that what he can say to these companies is, look, I've got this army of alligators, as he calls them, accredited investors that are qualified to invest in a private placement. There's going to be no commissions. I'm not even going to get involved in dealing with them. I'll just tell my subscribers to deal with the company directly. I charge my subscribers a fee for getting the newsletter. It's a very big fee, by the way. $3,500 newsletter has got to be the most expensive precious metals newsletter on the market. And then you can deal with them directly. There's no brokers, there's no commissions, whatever. But I want the warrants not to go to brokers, but to go to me and to the other investors. So the people that are buying the stock get the warrants. And then what Marin's added is his own little signature, which is those warrants normally are a contract between the investor and the company. They can't be traded publicly on any exchange. What Marin does is he gets those warrants publicly listed on an exchange so that the investors buying the stock not only get the ability to trade the stock once it goes public, but they also get the ability to trade the warrants as listed instruments on an exchange. And that's what's become known as a CATUSA warrant because Marin was the guy who started doing it. So it really is true that he is giving his investors the opportunity to invest in these companies on the same exact terms that he's investing in, almost. And the gotcha that he doesn't tell you is this. When Marin comes in, let's take JR Resources, a company that he's doing right now, and in the interest of full disclosure, which I'm investing in myself, Marin's the lead investor in that deal, $10 million check that he's writing personally. Well, when he says you can invest on the same terms he is, what you can't do, and by the way, Doug Casey tried to do it, is say, okay, Marin, I can invest in the same terms as you do. Okay, I'll take $10 million too. And the answer is, well, no, Marin's already like more than half of the deal at $10 million. There is no second $10 million that's available because the whole financing's not that big. So what is not being advertised is you can't invest in the size that Marin is investing in and get $10 million for yourself. In Casey's case, you know, he wanted several million. He ended up getting 100,000 or something. I wanted a large allocation. I ended up in that deal getting scaled back to only about 20% of what I asked for. And that particular one, there was a huge amount of interest and everybody got scaled back. So the place where it's not quite true that you're investing on the same terms that he is Marin puts all the work into the research, setting these deals up. He gets to keep as much of the deal for himself as he wants to. And whatever's left gets divided up among his subscribers. And it is, I think, a fantastic opportunity because Marin has done an excellent job of scouting out and finding these deals to invest in. There's no broker involved. It's not like a broker who, you know, if the broker is selling you the deal that he's getting a commission on as a percentage, whether it's a good deal or a bad deal, he's happy to sell you that deal. Marin is finding deals to invest in himself, and he's allowing his subscribers to invest on the same terms, but typically in much smaller size than he's investing. And it really depends on, you know, if you're, what you want is to be able to do $25,000 or $50,000 per deal investments, it's going to be fine. If you want to do several million dollars at a time, you're not going to have that opportunity because the deals are not that big. So that's where the gotcha is that maybe is not quite obvious. Now, as far as the other part that you asked about, which is he says to everybody, well, I'm going to tell you before I sell my stock so you can go first. Stop and think about that. Marin is an insider on most of these deals because the size of his investment is large enough that for exchange rules, he's reportable. He has to disclose publicly that he's going to sell before he start selling. So, you know, it is true that he does exactly what he promises, but I think he would kind of have to do that for regulatory reasons anyway. Bottom line, I think that the service that he's providing is excellent. It's my go-to spot for private placement deals in precious metals, which is where I prefer investing right now. But Patrick, this is not something that makes any sense for small investors. If your financial net worth is $25,000, you don't want to spend 10% of it on Marin's newsletter. That's crazy. I think you need a bare minimum of $50,000 to invest in the natural resources sector before it makes any sense to spend that kind of money, even with the big Macro Voices discount, on a newsletter. And I think it's particularly opportune for accredited investors who can get in on the private placement deals. It's just a question of realizing that you won't maybe be able to get as much size as you might have wanted to, as these deals are very popular and oversubscribed in a lot of cases.
Okay, let's move on to our main post-game topic, the U.S. election aftermath. Now, for weeks and weeks, you've been telling listeners that the question is not whether the U.S. presidential election will be contested, but rather how contested it will be and how much uncertainty and volatility that creates for the markets. So for this week's post-game topic, let's talk about the subject. How bad can it get here, Eric?
Patrick, I think this could get pretty bad, frankly. I did a bunch of research this week, and frankly, I was shocked to learn how much room the design of the Electoral College system leaves for uncertainty, and how many different ways this process could be derailed before the president is finally chosen. The whole system relies to a very large extent on state law, not federal law, to govern the actions of these electors, which are the people who take the popular vote and go and actually vote in the final election, which doesn't happen until December. So it's a big, muddy situation where the laws of each state are a little bit different. And the concept of precedent, where once something is decided in a court, that same decision binds on everybody else. Well, that's not true if you're talking about state law. If something happens in the Michigan election and a court makes a ruling on it, that doesn't establish a precedent that's going to have anything to do with the Arizona state court's interpretation of its laws, because it's a separate set of laws. So it's a very muddy, complex process, and each of these states have different laws. So it's very, very confusing.
Okay, let's walk through the process chronologically and discuss what could go wrong in each step of the way. Now, let's start what we know. Americans who choose to exercise the right have already cast their vote for the next president, either in person on Tuesday of this week or in advance through the early voting or the mail-in ballots, which had to be postmarked by Tuesday of this week in order to be counted, correct?
No, that's actually not correct. I thought it was correct too until I did some research on this. In the Electoral College system, citizens never directly vote for the president. So when a citizen votes for John Doe or Joe Biden or Donald Trump or whatever, what they're saying is, I want my state to choose electors. There's 538 people called electors who have the intention of casting their vote in the actual presidential election, the real presidential election, which, by the way, doesn't happen until the 14th of December. I want my state to choose electors who are going to cast their vote for the guy that I voted for. So if I voted for John Doe, I want my state to choose one of those 538 electors to be somebody who's going to go and vote for John Doe in the presidential election, which doesn't happen till December. Now, the only reason that everybody acts as if the president was chosen on November 3rd is the assumption that the states are going to choose electors that represent the will of the people that were voting in that state. And those electors are, in fact, going to go and vote for the candidate that their state's citizens voted to elect. And the rules differ from state to state. This is a matter of state law, not federal law. And so, for example, Maine and Nebraska, the way it works there is the electors are chosen by congressional district. So you could have half of Maine's Electoral College votes go to Joe Biden and the other half go to Donald Trump. Didn't work out that way, or at least it hasn't so far. But in all the other states, there's a different rule where the winner takes all. So one candidate wins the entire state and all of the Electoral College votes for that state go to that candidate. There's lots and lots of smaller details that vary from state to state. I just gave you an example of a big one. But the point is, it's state laws and they're all different.
Okay, but once those electors have been chosen in the election we just had, presumably they're required by law to cast their votes according to the will of the people. So in effect, it's the same thing as the people choosing the president on November 3rd, isn't it?
Well, Patrick, that is exactly what I thought, and it turns out to be wrong. You know, you'd think logically, well, surely if the whole purpose of these electors is to carry out the will of the people, surely they must be required by the federal law that they have to vote for the guy that their state voted for, you know, take that vote forward. Otherwise, it's, I don't know, treason or something. No, federal law does not require the electors to vote as they pledged. Now, when they don't, they're called faithless electors. There's a Wikipedia page about that that's worth reading. Faithless electors. There have been 165 of them in U.S. history. And in some cases, it makes sense. You know, in one case, there was a president who's elected. The guy died after the November election, before the December elector vote. And, you know, obviously, it doesn't make sense to vote for a dead guy. So those electors ended up voting for a different candidate from that party who was still alive. Now, there have been electors that not for because of a dead guy, but just because they didn't believe anymore in what they were supposed to do that broke their pledge. So what you'd think it would make sense to outlaw this? Well, the Supreme Court has ruled that the states, not the federal government, but the states have the authority, if they want to impose laws requiring the electors to vote faithfully, to vote for who the people of their state voted for, and to set penalties if they don't. The thing is, only 33 out of 50 states have enacted laws like that. The remaining states allow faithless voting, where an elector, if he chooses to, can vote for somebody other than who the people voted for. And that election, the one that really chooses the president of the United States, only 538 people voted it, and it doesn't happen until December 14th. A whole lot can happen between now and December 14th. And the rules that govern whether or not each elector is required to vote for the person that their state called for, and if they don't, if they break it, does that mean that the vote is overturned, or does it just mean that that elector gets some penalty, a fine or something, but the vote still stands? Well, it depends on the state, and this is not academic or hypothetical or anything, faithless electors have never changed the outcome of a U.S. presidential election, but under the law, they could. In the 2016 election, there were 10 faithless electors, 10 people who didn't vote for who they were supposed to vote for. And in that case, you know, it didn't change the outcome because they would have needed 37 to not carry the vote of Donald Trump. But this is not hypothetical. It's real.
Okay, 2016 was when Donald Trump won the majority of the Electoral College votes in the popular election by the citizens, but Hillary Clinton was said to have actually carried the popular vote. Was that the reason the electors didn't vote as pledged?
That might have had something to do with why people were asking them not to vote as pledged. But what happened in that case is a lot of people on both sides were outraged by the election process in 2016. So there were 10 electors that voted unfaithfully, casting their votes for third-party candidates such as Ron Paul, Bernie Sanders, Colin Powell, and Faith Spotted Eagle. Three of those votes were overturned because they came from states where the state law said not only is the elector required to vote for who they're supposed to vote for, but if they fail to, then the vote doesn't count. So three of those votes were overturned, but the other seven came from states that didn't have laws like that. So those seven unfaithful votes where the elector voted for somebody other than the people that they were supposed to vote for, according to the outcome of the November election, the result of that, those seven unfaithful votes were upheld by the court. They just weren't enough to change the outcome of the election. Hillary Clinton lost five electoral votes to unfaithful electors who were supposed to vote for her but voted for someone else because they were influenced not to vote for her. Donald Trump lost two electoral votes this way, but it wasn't enough to change the election. Now, the thing is, what happened in 2016, at least on the Trump side, there was a movement, an organized group of people called the Hamilton electors. And they worked very hard to try to influence. What they were doing is lobbying to try to find 37 Republican electors to defect and not vote for Donald Trump as they had pledged to do because their state's population had chosen Donald Trump. If they could get 37 electors to defect and not vote for the guy they were supposed to and instead cast their vote for Ron Paul or Mickey Mouse or whatever, somebody other than Donald Trump, then Trump would have lost the election. Those electors were subjected to coercion, including death threats. Now, that was 2016, Patrick. If people were willing to resort to death threats in 2016, well, consider the political climate then versus now. You know, what would they do now in this much more heightened, much more tense situation? I couldn't even find a rule. I mean, what happens if it's not just a death threat? What if somebody assassinated an elector in order to eliminate that vote? I'm not even sure if there's a procedure for that. If the law considers it, I couldn't find it.
Okay, so the president is actually chosen by the 538 electors, not the people directly. So the 538 electors are chosen by the people in the election we just had this Tuesday, but the results of the election aren't even certified yet. So what is actually being counted and certified here?
Well, the choice of who the electors are that are supposed to cast their votes is what's being chosen. In other words, there's somebody lined up in each state. You know, this is the guy, if Biden wins, so-and-so is going to be the elector, and a different guy is going to be the elector if Trump wins. And presumably, so the vote that we had on Tuesday was to choose those electors, and those electors do pledge in most states, almost all states, they make a pledge to vote for the candidate that the people voted for, but they're not required by federal law to actually do so. So the first hurdle is in each state, not the federal government, has to go through its own process of counting the votes and choosing its electors. The electors are people who were chosen by their party for their loyalty to that party. So if a Republican elector is chosen because Donald Trump got the popular vote in that state, that elector, the person who's chosen, is likely to be personally very committed to voting for Donald Trump, regardless of what happens next. So now imagine that in a swing state like Pennsylvania, let's suppose that the votes are counted and Trump is the winner, at least on the initial count. And so the elector who is loyal to Trump is chosen by that state in the election. But then let's say a week later, after that elector is chosen, millions and millions of mail-in ballots for Biden are discovered, along with, let's say, a conspiracy of postal workers who were hiding those Biden votes and you know, not allowing them to get through or something. So the state Supreme Court, and this is just a hypothetical scenario, suppose that the state Supreme Court looks at the situation and orders the chosen elector, who's a person that's likely to be very loyal to Trump, and say, look, we're the state Supreme Court. We're ordering you, Mr. Elector, to carry out the will of the people. Now that we've discovered this inconsistency, it's too late to change who the elector is, so you're still the elector, but we're ordering you, as a matter of court order, to vote for Biden instead, because that's the will of the people after we counted all the mail-in ballots. Okay, you're in total, complete, uncharted territory there. Does the state Supreme Court have the authority to make that order? Does the elector have to follow it? If the elector doesn't vote for the guy he's supposed to, or if he ignores the state Supreme Court and votes for Trump anyway, did he do anything wrong? The federal law does not prohibit the elector from voting for Trump or for Biden, regardless of whatever else happens. Well, what is the consequence? You know that in uncharted legal territory, everybody's going to be making a legal argument for whatever they want to have happen. So my real point here is not that specific hypothetical scenario, but just that there are zillions and zillions of possibilities as to what could happen at any stage of this process after the electors are chosen, but before the actual election happens, after the election happens, but before the January meeting of the joint session of Congress where the votes are read. Things can change at any point along the way, and there's all kinds of possibilities for things to go wrong. Now, the states have a deadline of December 8th. It's called Safe Harbor Day. By December 8th, they have to choose their electors. Well, what if a state has chosen its electors, and it's chosen the Trump electors because Trump won, and you know they wanted to certify the outcome as soon as they could. Trump wants, and then 3 days later, they discover millions of votes for Biden, and the state Supreme Court or the state legislature or somebody says, okay, we're going to change it. We take it back. We don't want the Trump guy to be the elector. After all, it's going to be the Biden guy. Do they have the authority to change it after they've already announced it? Nobody knows. There's no clear precedent or case law to cover that. It's not clear in the way that the law is written. Could be argued either way. There's a law about this, which was brought into effect after a contested election back in the 1800s. It's called the Electoral Count Act, and it governs many aspects of this. It is widely criticized by legal scholars as potentially the most self-contradicting and confusing and just generally ineffective piece of legislation ever written. So you've got a really screwed up piece of law, body of law called the Electoral Count Act that governs a lot of this. Nobody's really sure how to interpret it, and there's not a lot of case law. My risk assessment, make this simple. Divide 10 faithless electors that you had in the 2016 presidential election. I didn't even know that story until I learned it this week. Take those 10 faithless electors, divide that by whatever your personal assessment is of the degree of public discontentment that existed in November of 2016, then multiply the result by your assessment of that discontentment that exists now. That's the expected value of the faithless vote potential in this election. And at any point along the way, if new information is discovered and a state says, oh, we got to change who our elector is, there's no process for that. It's not clear whether they have the authority to do it. If a state tells an elector, you have to vote for somebody other than who you had originally pledged to vote for because there's new information, there's no case law for that. There's no precedent for that. Nobody knows what the law is in that case. Everybody will be arguing their own story. So there are zillions and zillions of possible outcomes of things that could go wrong here along the way.
Okay. So far, the key takeaways are that the American people did not choose the next president this Tuesday. They voted to choose the 538 electors who are supposed to vote the will of the people in the actual presidential election in December. But under the law, and as evidenced by history as recent as the last election in 2016, the electors did not always vote the way they pledged to vote. And there's plenty of reason to assume that complication factors that could lead to faithless electors voting against the candidate they pledged to support are more numerous in this election than any other. Now, let's move on to what happens next. Once the states have all counted the votes that were cast by Tuesday this week and have chosen those 530 electors, what happens next?
Well, the actual presidential election, in which only those 538 electors are allowed to vote, that doesn't happen until December 14th. And there's lots of opportunities for new evidence to come into play between now and December 14th, either before the electors are chosen by the states or after the state chooses its electors, and maybe new information that might have led to a different conclusion comes out after the elector is chosen. So that could be voter fraud. It could be uncounted mail-in ballots. And we've already seen a couple of examples of that just in the last 36 hours or so. In Arizona, there is at least one case where the official uniform poll workers are handing out these Sharpie markers for people to fill out their ballots with. And there were reportedly observers who were there saying, hey, wait a minute. Don't do that. Those Sharpie markers, you're not allowed to use those. That will invalidate the thing. Here's some ballpoint pens. Use these ballpoint pens instead. The polling staff that were handing out the Sharpie markers called the police and got the people trying to hand out ballpoint pens forced to stop doing so. Then afterwards, when they go to count the votes, all of the votes that are marked with Sharpie markers are disqualified because exactly as the guys handing out the ballpoint pens said was going to happen, you're not allowed to fill out the vote in that state with a Sharpie marker for some reason, even though the staff were handing out those to people. You know, that was one example. There was another situation that came up in Michigan where supposedly a postal worker came forward as a whistleblower saying that he and his colleagues were ordered by their management to take ballots that were received on the 4th of November, a day late, if you will, and separate those from the other mail so that they could be manually postmarked, back postmarked to November 3rd so that they would be counted even though they had missed the deadline. Now, we don't know if either of those stories are actually true, but the point is there's going to be more stories like this. There's going to be more stuff coming out that's going to confuse this whole process, and it's going to upset a lot of people. Another direction this could take, Patrick, you could have new evidence come out about unlawful conduct or corruption on either candidate. You know, Joe Biden has been accused of wrongful activities in both China and Ukraine, and Hunter Biden has been accused of inappropriate activity, trading in his father's name and so forth. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has been accused of having a Chinese bank account and other kinds of things. Both candidates have been accused of seemingly corrupt things by their critics. Well, new information could come out on either candidate that could influence this whole process. So there's no clear precedent on how electors are supposed to respond to new news that comes out after they've been chosen as an elector. There's also no clear precedent on whether or not a state legislature or a state court has the authority to direct an elector to vote for someone other than the one that they originally pledged, because let's say the vote is recounted or something. If any state were to try to replace an elector after new information is collected and say, hey, you know, we changed our mind, you're not the elector after all, it's unknown as to whether or not they have that authority. That would be challenged for sure in court. Come November 14th, the electors eventually meet in each state's capital. So there is no nationwide meeting where they all go together in one place. It's in each state capital that the electors for that state meet. The president and the vice presidential choices are made. The results are sent via registered mail to the president of the Senate and to several other independent parties. The idea is if there's a dispute, there's several different people who all received a copy of it that can corroborate the information and make sure it's correct.
Okay, so we don't really know whether the electors are going to vote for the candidate they were chosen to vote for until December 14th. And history teaches us that they don't always vote as expected or pledged. But it sounds like once we get through the vote on December 14th, that the election is a done deal and the identity of the next president is certain. Is that right?
Well, you'd think so, but no, it doesn't work that way. The next step is a full meeting of both houses of Congress on January 6th. Each state's votes are read out loud in that joint session. Now, any state vote can be objected, not just by that state, but any a combination of any one senator and any one representative. And that's it doesn't have to be from that state, anybody from anywhere in the country. Combination of one senator and one representative can object to a vote from any state for any reason. If an objection is stated, the joint session is suspended and both houses of Congress have independent debates on the merits of that objection. Some or all of any state's votes can be rejected and not counted if the objection is upheld by both houses. For practical purposes, there are no legal rules. There's no, you know, rule of unreasonable doubt or anything like that. It's basically the politicians get to vote, and if they can get enough people in favor of something, they can uphold an objection and they can disqualify and not count the votes from a state if they can get enough people to gang up on that state and vote against including it. Now, objections were raised in 2000. Actually, January 6th makes it 2001 in the Bush-Gore election, but only representatives from the House had objected. There was no objection from the Senate, so therefore they didn't consider it and they didn't actually suspend the joint session. All it would have taken is one out of 100 senators to defect and want to support just hearing the objection, and that would have forced that joint session of Congress to break down, and each House of Congress would separately debate the merits of the objection. So it only takes one defector to change this. Didn't happen in 2000, but we've got a lot more divisiveness now than we had in 2000. If one candidate receives 270 votes or more after objected votes are disqualified, so after you've taken out whatever you're going to disqualify because of objections, if you've still got an absolute majority, then a president is elected. If not, the House of Representatives chooses the president and the Senate chooses the vice president. So in theory, a Biden president and Pence vice president, you know, the Democrat wins the presidency, but the Republican wins the vice presidency, and you get two guys that don't like each other as president and vice president. That is entirely possible if the Senate were to choose Mike Pence and the House were to choose Joe Biden. Each state in that scenario gets one vote. So the whole electoral college system, where California has 55 votes, but a little state like Maine only has 4 votes. So there's like a 14-1 difference there. Well, Maine and California have the same vote in this special session of Congress that would occur. If there's a deadlock on the president and only a vice president becomes elected, then the vice president becomes the acting president until a president is elected. If there's a deadlock on both, the Speaker of the House becomes acting president. Now, think about that. There's a scenario there where Democrats could filibuster that special session of Congress to intentionally allow Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House to take the presidency. The thing is, in order to pull that off, they would have to somehow make sure that the Senate deadlocked as well and didn't choose a vice president, and it would be unlikely for them to be able to do that. My point is not that, you know, it's at all likely that Nancy Pelosi would ever take the presidency. My point is there's an insane number of possible scenarios that could play out here. Everybody in the mainstream media is assuming this thing's going to be settled in the next day or two. I don't think it's going to be. At any time in this process, legal challenges pertaining to the electors all have to be resolved at the state government level, not at the federal level. So there is no, you know, the situation a lot of people imagine is the federal Supreme Court steps in and just decides the outcome and that's it. Really, that's not true. It would be a whole bunch of state Supreme Courts making independent decisions about the states that would eventually do that. Undoubtedly, The losers are going to demand that the Supreme Court of the United States intervenes eventually. So, you know, is this all going to be sorted out by January 20th? If it's not sorted out, the fallback is Nancy Pelosi. Well, or, you know, if it can be sorted out to the point where there is no president or vice president, then Nancy Pelosi is president until there is one. I don't think it'll come to that, but it's going to be a really interesting ride from here to January 20th, and I don't think it gets resolved in the next couple days.
Well, Eric, thanks for providing our listeners with that reassurance that democracy is still intact in the United States. Anyway, final question. What's your personal take on all of this?
Well, again, the logical way to calculate the expected value of this potential risk factor is to divide what happened in 2001 and 2016, how crazy things got then, divide that by the degree of public discord that existed at those times, then multiply the result by the current level of public discord and general pissed-offedness that exists in society. That's an inherently subjective calculation, and it leads to a result, obviously, which is biased by the perspectives of the person performing the calculation. When I apply that methodology of investment analysis, the conclusion I come to is we could be looking at a clusterfuck on steroids before this thing is over. So I predict that electoral college reform is going to be one of the biggest political issues between now and the 2024 election. And by the way, folks, the same distributed ledger technology that solves the double spending problem in Bitcoin could solve all of this election nonsense for once and for all, so that everybody has exactly one vote and a public ledger clearly shows on a pseudonymous level what the audit trail is of who voted how, and there's no room for fraud. It's so easy to solve this with technology. Unfortunately, I don't think there's any chance of that actually happening in our political system. The point of this whole segment that we're doing here, though, folks, is I was unaware of how much room there is, how complex this process is, how intricate and frankly screwed up a lot of the laws are that govern all of this, and particularly the part where it's individual states that have to sort out all of the disputes and discrepancies. There's a whole lot that can go wrong between here and December 8th when the electors have to be chosen, December 14th when the electors choose the president, and January 6th when potentially those votes from the electors could be objected to by any combination of just one representative and one senator, and that could derail this whole electoral process. So there's a whole lot left that can still go wrong. And I suspect that if there's a market crash resulting from this, that it would probably be short-lived. I think you could see a lot of downside volatility as people realize that this thing is less under control than I think a lot of people realize right now. Unless it goes to all-out civil war, which is a possibility, frankly, but I don't think the most likely outcome, then eventually it's going to be a buy-the-dip moment. There's going to be a V-shaped recovery, and we all know there's going to be a huge amount of stimulus on the other side of this that's probably going to propel markets higher. But I think there's plenty of room to leave possibility that there is a whole lot of volatility and potentially market downside still ahead of us. Now, of course, you could have either side capitulate and concede defeat tomorrow, and that would just end the whole thing. And I think markets go up from there if that happens. I don't see that happening, and I think it's going to be a rougher ride than most people are expecting. In any event, Patrick, on that pleasant note, let's move on to our post-game chart book titled, Is the Reflation Trade Dead? Listeners, you'll find the post-game chart book linked in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, is the reflation trade dead? Let's dive in and look at page 2, S&P 500 and VIX side by side. What are these charts telling us?
Well, first, before we get to the reflation trade story, I wanted to just talk about the first impulse that happened in the post-election period. Going into the election, everyone was scared. Volatility was high. Everyone was degrossing, deleveraging, and there was a very large amount of hedges being put on into the markets. And when you have those kind of conditions, there's reflexivity that can happen that just as this more certainty comes on the other side, that this all gets unwound and money gets put back into the market. One thing that we saw on the volatility was, like we talked about last week, that in the post-election period, volatility can normalize. We had a drop from like the 37 level down to about the 27 level on the VIX in literally a day or two. And there's an impact that happens to option dealers when there's all these options open for put protection on the downside of a portfolio. When volatility contracts, there's this option term we call VANA, which is reflecting a how much delta changes on options, particularly out of the money options, when volatility contracts or expands. And in this case, when volatility implodes, the amount of delta exposure that dealers had also contracted. In doing so, they did not have to be as short as they had to be hedged. And in fact, so they were short covering and providing additional fuel on top of a lot of traders that were waiting for the election results to buy, plus a lot of the FOMO that was coming in when everyone's seeing the market rallying in that post period. So we have this reflexive rally in the market. The big question now that we're approaching this 3,500 level on the S&P, this is where there's some call walls where there's huge open interest that could pin the market up here along those previous highs. Be really interesting going into next week to see whether the bulls can build on this momentum or whether this was just a quick snap that is going to mean revert. And that's definitely what we're watching next week. But what I wanted to move on was on page three, talk about the 10-year treasury yield. What I have in that little window is a Bank of America research thing that was coming out, was talking about the different scenarios of the election and what it would mean on a macro scale. And what you can see there highlighted in the red box was the Biden win with a Republican Senate, or basically a divided government, and that would lead to deflation. And what was the almost immediate result that we saw in the post-election period was treasury yields collapse from 90 basis points down to like 77 basis points, without almost a 15 basis point swing in 24 hours on yields in that period. And coupled with that, obviously, was the byproduct on page four, which is a lot of people go long duration, particularly long growth and technology and momentum in periods of disinflationary pressure. And so immediately the momentum over value trade started to work again. And one of the more interesting things in the next week is to see, is this a trend that can continue? And so the idea that a lot of people are out there talking about is that this reflation trade died on the election. But you know what? I find that there's a lot of conflicts to this theme. And that's where on page five, when we go to that dollar index chart, we can see the dollar continues to be very weak. And when you think about inflation and reflation trades, the typical things that we would see in the macro intermarkets is weak dollar and bullish commodities. And that usually leads to the inflationary pressure and higher break evens that lead to higher yields. And what we're seeing is that even though the bond market had that reaction, what we're seeing is the dollar remains very weak. And when we go to page six, where we have the commodity, Bloomberg Commodity Index futures, or crude oil on page seven, or gold on page eight, or copper on page nine, all of them remain somewhat stable and look like they're bullishly rolling up. And so this conflicting chart as to it's not decided yet which way this is going. And the point I really want to get at is I don't think I want to make the call that the reflation trade is dead yet. I think that we need a little bit more information, because these charts are all over the place. And being able to put the puzzle pieces together in the coming week or two as to which way this is going to break is going to be a key to how you position your portfolio. And that's definitely what we're going to keep an eye on.
Well, definitely, we're going to have continuing coverage both between you and I and with our expert guests on the program. I think the thing to keep in the back of your head, though, folks, is, you know, as much as there's a lot of uncertainty, and I don't think that we're going to, I'll be very surprised if we know with certainty by next week's podcast, which will be, what, 9 days after the election, if we know with certainty who the president is. I think it'll probably have become certain, but then we'll be starting to question whether or not it stays certain at that point. One way or another, though, someday it will be resolved. We'll know who's president. You know what? There's going to be more stimulus. Fiat currencies are going to be debased by governments, and there's going to be a lot of infrastructure spending and stimulus spending, no matter what. So it's plenty of room to look at different ways this could go, but I think there are also some macro trends which are pretty darn clear already. What do you think people should be focusing on in this period of uncertainty, Patrick. You talk every single day, almost every day, 4 days a week. You do webinars for your big picture trading clients. What are you going to be focusing on in the next week or so when, frankly, we don't know what the answer is yet on the president?
I think the reaction in the bond market may have been overdone. There was an incredibly large amount of short interest in the bond market, and it created a short squeeze. And that may have been more of a liquidity event than an indication of a new trend. And so I think the most important thing is that, will the dollar continue to be weak? Will commodities continue to be strong? Is the gold breakout for real? And is the bond market going to follow through? Or was this just a short-term liquidity event, and then the bond market just comes back in line and all of those charts line up? That's, I think, the biggest thing to watch for. And that's what I'm going to continue to watch for with my members.
And listeners, if you want to tune in and join Patrick for those webinars, you can sign up for a free 14-day trial of Big Picture Trading. Just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's episode. This episode was made possible by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium. And by the Perth Mint's Gold Pass, the market-leading investment and trading app from the Perth Mint. Buy, sell, transfer, and redeem government-guaranteed gold securely on your smartphone. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book that we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a Variant Perception blog titled Steeper and Cheaper, and a link to an article asking if oil prices are set to go higher next year. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. The internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit bigpicturetrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.